The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. A coalition of immigrant advocacy groups is asking a federal judge for a restraining order that could block the Trump administration from forcing asylum seekers to stay in Mexico while their cases make their way through U.S. immigration courts. In a motion filed yesterday, the advocates argue that the administration's new policy, which officials started rolling out in Tijuana last month, causes irreparable harm and places vulnerable asylum seekers' lives at risk. In court documents, the coalition argued that asylum seekers are being returned to Mexico without any meaningful consideration for the dangers that they face there, including the very real threat that Mexican authorities will return them to their countries that they fled from, and they will face persecution and torture and even death there. The Trump administration has dubbed the policy migrant protection protocols, and they have argued that this helps restore a safe and orderly immigration process. The court filings come as officials have argued and they've suggested that they plan to expand this policy, which immigrant rights groups argue violates U.S. and international law. What is happening with asylum seekers on our southern border? What are their rights under the law? And what is the responsibility of the U.S. government? And what do you want to see happen? Call in with your questions and comments as we talk about asylum seekers' rights. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And you can email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at tprsource. We're joined this hour with the Honorable A. Ashley Tabador. She's the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. Erica Schumer is an immigration law faculty member at St. Mary's University School of Law. And Pilar Martinez is a law student and symposium organizer for The Scholar, St. Mary's Law Review on Race and Social Justice. Welcome, all of you. It's great to have you here this afternoon. And again, the number is 210-614-8980. We really want to hear what the community has to say about what's happening with asylum seekers, particularly on our southern border, but also around the world. So, Judge Ashley Tabador, as the National Association of Immigration Judges, what does that mean? What are you the president of here?
That's a perfect question. Thank you for having me. So, what this means is that as immigration judges, we have been forced to unionize. And I know that that concept of immigration judges or judges in union may seem a little bit at odds, but that's because immigration judges are part of the workforce in the Department of Justice. We are individuals who've been appointed to our position by the Attorney General. And in that odd structure, while we are judges in terms of our duties and responsibilities, technically we're considered federal government attorneys. And so the only way that we can really advocate for our working conditions or raise issues regarding the structure of the court or what's impacting the court is through unionizing and using labor law as a protection and a vehicle to raise those issues.
It's turned out right now that the real estate inside a immigration courtroom has become a big focus of what's happening in the nation these days as we talk about the rights of asylum seekers and also anyone who comes in contact with the immigration system. And the immigration law has been described as Byzantine, complex, maybe overly complex. It takes someone with a vast knowledge in order to make sense of that and also arrive at fair decisions. So congratulations to anyone who becomes an immigration judge, I believe.
Yes, the challenges are absolutely real, and they've become much more compelling in the last few years.
There is a strong line of direction from the Attorney General, U.S. Attorney General, to the immigration judges that we have in the United States. They get their a lot of their policies and directions come directly from the Attorney General. When we had William Jefferson Sessions as the AG, he made certain changes to what they wanted. He wanted immigration judges to do, and it seemed like he was directing them to be more harsh and trying to be more expeditious in trying to arrive at their conclusions, but and decisions and rulings. Then we lost that Attorney General. We had Whitaker. He was a placeholder. And now for the last 3 days, we've had William Barr, our new Attorney General. What are your expectations with him?
Well, I think a lot of people do not fully appreciate what it means when we talk about an immigration court and immigration judges. There's some common assumptions about the use of the word court and judge. And unfortunately, those assumptions don't carry over when it comes to the immigration court and immigration judges. And as you mentioned, we are under the authority of the Attorney General, and the Attorney General is our number one federal prosecutor who is acting in the executive branch's law enforcement priorities. So what has happened is that the immigration court and judges have been used essentially as extension of each administration's law enforcement priorities in various ways. Frankly, sometimes I say, you know, we're still trying to recover from the whiplash 3 years ago, completely one side of the pendulum. Now we're on the other side of the pendulum. We've seen the issues that arise from having a court in a law enforcement agency become much more transparent over the last couple of years with the use of the certification process. You mentioned Attorney General Sessions sort of coming in and directing a number of cases and through which he used to sort of reshape the court and provide mandates for the court. And we're continuing to see that same focus on the immigration court on a big push for speed. Everything is focused on just numbers. That's something we hadn't really had in the way that we've seen recently. And in terms of your question of the new Attorney General Barr, while it remains to be seen, I certainly don't know what is in his mind. We hope that there will be a little bit more even-handedness towards the court. So we've requested a meeting with him, and we hope that we can have an opportunity to sit with him and share some of our recommendations and concerns.
But with President Trump, the big man in the Oval Office, he's basically calls the tune. Then the Attorney General is expected to go along with that, or at least under a Trump administration, it's coming from the Oval Office.
Yes, the executive branch and the Oval Office are obviously one and the same. And so the policies and the directives are ultimately one that's being shaped from the Oval Office and then being implemented through the various agencies, including the Justice Department.
So this puts a lot of immigration judges in difficult positions. This is not why they became immigration judges, to carry out some of these policies that are being directed at them. Many of them are being told to as far as transgender individuals who find themselves in court, who are fear being deported back into these countries. That's no longer grounds for asylum, right?
No, I don't believe that's a correct statement, but I think what you mentioned is correct in that our judges are supposed to be independent decision makers. We take an oath of office. We are supposed to be impartial and true to the Constitution and laws of the United States. However, because we are in the Justice Department, in the court system governed by the Attorney General, the policy mandates that have been issued and enforced on judges really places the judge in a very awkward situation. For example, this big push for increase in speed and numbers. We are now facing an unprecedented step of being subjected to quotas and deadlines. And that is something that you would never do to a judge, because you're now introducing a personal financial interest into each case, something that just is not acceptable in a traditional court setting.
And then we had the government shutdown.
That's right.
Which froze these courtrooms for weeks, and that has just put these things in disarray. We're going to take a break. We're going to continue talking about asylum seekers' rights. If you've got questions or comments, the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this break. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin. Davies. We're talking about asylum seekers' rights. We invite you into the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. Todd is on the line. And hi, Todd. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have experience doing humanitarian work abroad and quite a bit of experience in Central America. My brother lived in Panama. And I, my concern is I believe we should have a middle ground between the extreme that we see with the Trump administration and the extreme, which is completely open borders, let everyone in. I think the answer to this is to have an amnesty where even the people that are already here illegally are given amnesty, where they have background checks done. Those that came here as adults illegally should, in my opinion, start paying taxes, pay some kind of reasonable fine for coming here illegally that's taken out of their check, reasonable, and then have a pathway to citizenship. The Dreamers, it wasn't their fault. They were children. They were innocent. They should have a pathway to citizenship, in my opinion. The others to permanent residency, those that came here as adults illegally. And because we tried banning alcohol, we tried banning guns and drugs, doesn't work. Same thing with people. Sensible regulation brings it out of the shadows, and that's going to help protect these women that are being exploited as they are brought here by coyotes. And I've met people when I was in Panama who were willing to pay a lot of money. And I told them, don't do it. You're not going to get your papers. They're going to exploit you. They're going to hurt you.
Right. Todd, thank you for that call. So this is an opinion that a lot of people, there's a lot of opinions out there that cross the spectrum about what we should be doing about immigration and asylum seekers in the United States. It's become a political hot button and driving a lot of our decision-making in the United States when we go to the polling places. Erica Schomer, can you talk about, as your immigration law facility faculty member at St. Mary's University School of Law, some of the options that Todd is talking about and whether or not that's on the table?
Sure. I mean, I think under this administration, the idea of a comprehensive immigration reform is not something that's going to go forward, or if it did, it would not do what the caller was suggesting as far as giving people who have been here a long time a path to citizenship. We have seen what I deem to be an assault on asylum seekers, and I think that in part of the debate, there's a real problem in the public perception of demonizing people who are coming here because their lives are in danger. And under U.S. law, the only way to seek asylum is to get into the U.S. physically and say, I'm afraid to go back to my country. I need protection. People can do that by approaching a border and making that claim. Under the Trump administration, unfortunately, we've seen people pushed to wait up to months to be able to be processed. And so that has caused asylum seekers to also cross illegally because they can't wait in very dangerous situations in Mexico to come across and make that claim. So when people kind of say, well, I want people to come here, I'm not opposed to immigration, I want them to come here legally, someone who's seeking asylum has to physically get on U.S. soil. That is the process.
So that is following the law to come to the United States, cross the border, go to a customs agent, Border Patrol agent, and say, I am seeking asylum.
That's the only option.
But now we're having Border Patrol guards blocking their entry at bridges and saying, we don't want you. You can't come in here. We don't want to hear your plea for asylum.
Right. It's been painted as this capacity issue that, you know, so different ports of entry will say, well, today we can only process 8 people. Tomorrow we can process 30 people. But having agents standing literally on the line in the middle of the bridges in the Rio Grande Valley, checking people's papers, trying to figure out, okay, are you a visa crosser? Then you can pass this line. So we're kind of setting up a preliminary inspection point. And for asylum seekers, there are these essentially illegal lists of people, putting them in line to be able to come and make their claims, which is a violation of U.S. law.
But one of Todd's points, he put out a spectrum of options saying, you know, some people want to shut down the border, and other people want to have open borders and allowing everyone through. Open borders, that's not really something that's being proposed. There is no open border advocates that are being, you know, that's not a position.
That's correct. I don't know of any advocacy organization that is pushing an open border agenda. I mean, I think everyone living in the U.S. understands that we need to have security. And that's kind of one of the things that I think is interesting in the debate of what to do with people who are here, like the Dreamers, and other people who are here without status. If we really were concerned about security, doesn't it make more sense to create a process for people to register where they're fingerprinted, where they can get driver's licenses and people can be tracked? By pushing a population into the shadows where they're not even allowed to have a driver's license, we're really creating this underclass that doesn't make us any safer because we don't know who's here.
So there is a symposium event today. And to tell us more about that, Pilar Martinez, what is happening?
So this afternoon on St. Mary's campus, we've invited Starnata Reynolds. She's a world-renowned international human rights attorney. She'll be speaking about an article she's publishing with the scholar from 3 to 5 on St. Mary's campus in the Law Library.
And this is part of a number of events that y'all are having, including a symposium tomorrow?
Yes. So this is the pre-symposium event. And then tomorrow, all day, we have a CLE event, a continuing legal education event, which will be held at the Pearl.
And that is called Fighting to Keep Families Together.
Yes, correct.
So tell me about that title.
So it started actually last summer when I started organizing this during the family separation crisis. And it just seemed like an appropriate theme for this symposium because of that crisis that we need to start the theme being for attorneys, for them to have a place to come and learn about different topics in immigration law dealing with family separation and means for them to keep fighting for families to stay together.
So family separation was a tactic that was developed by the U.S. government in order to be a deterrent for asylum seekers. Is that how that was that arrived at? Do you want to talk about that, Erica Schomer?
Sure. Yes, I think in hindsight, we can say that it was absolutely implemented to send a message and with the idea that if people knew that their children would be taken from them, they wouldn't come. So the administration decided that they would prosecute every single person who crossed the border illegally, even if they had children with them. And, you know, everybody saw what happened, heard the video clips of children crying for their parents, and it was horrendous. But the fact of the matter is that people who are fleeing for their lives aren't thinking about what's going to happen when they cross the border. They are doing what they need to do to save their children, so that that deterrent effect it comes from a place of a fundamental misunderstanding of why people come to seek asylum in the first place.
So when people seek asylum, they have to demonstrate that they have a credible threat against them in their homeland. So Judge Tabador, can you talk about what do you consider a credible threat under the in the courts?
So in order to be eligible for asylum, you have to demonstrate that you're a refugee. And this is part of our commitment to international law in protecting individuals who are fearful of persecution. It's a legal term, which means a threat that's beyond just sort of minimal threat or injury or harm that's compelling. But it has to be connected to what we call a protected ground. There are only five reasons for which you can seek asylum, and that is political opinion, race, nationality, religion, and sort of a catch-all phrase of particular social group. If you can demonstrate that your life or sort of your life or limb, so to speak, is in serious danger because of those reasons and the government is unable or unwilling to provide you with protection, then you qualify as a refugee and through that mechanism can seek asylum and gain some protections. Asylum has some additional requirements. For example, it is ultimately a discretionary decision, so the judge can still find that you may have met the definition of refugee but should not be given asylum because of, let's say, certain criminal activities or other negative factors. There are specific criminal bars, so if there's specific types of crimes for which the person has been convicted, that can disqualify them. So in addition to just meeting that refugee definition, there are additional hurdles to becoming eligible for asylum protection.
So I've done some reporting in Honduras on the ground there and talking to people who are leaving Honduras, fleeing, and also here talking to people who are seeking asylum. And a typical story is that they are running from gangs who have become, they've superseded the government in controlling areas, and they prey upon individuals, sexual exploitation, threatening murder, all sorts of extortion activities, and they feel like they have to flee. And they're being targeted also because of their evangelical beliefs as well. They're not willing to become a criminal themselves. But how does that blend with being able to achieve asylum-seeking status for them?
So I think that goes back to what we have been sort of highlighting in terms of the importance of having an independent court and independent judges, because under the law, every person is entitled to have their claim considered on the basis of the facts of those of their particular situation under the law. So just because the experience is from a private actor doesn't necessarily disqualify you. It is one of the considerations. You have to look to see, why is this person targeting the individual? What is the role of the government? And it really is very, very fact intensive under the rubric of the refugee laws that we talked about.
So how do you prove that? I mean, I've seen them produce newspaper clippings and things like that. But when you're traveling up from Central America by foot all the way to the Texas-Mexico border, you can't bring a whole lot of documentation with you.
Yes, and Congress has contemplated that. If you take a look at the law, Congress has set forth very, very specific factors that the judge can consider under the law in determining someone's credibility. And credibility is a very, very big part of assessing someone's eligibility for asylum. And that requires time. It requires time to sit, listen to the person, be able to have question and answers. The government will have an opportunity to cross-examine them. And of course, to the extent that there's evidence that's reasonably available, you can request to have that be produced. But we're now facing a situation where judges are being constantly told that they have to do more cases faster. And so there's this big push to reduce the amount of time that each case is afforded. And that's the big challenge, is that it's putting the judges, again, in this rock and a hard place, stuck between a rock and a hard place in terms of their oath of office and their worry of losing their job if they don't finish enough cases fast enough.
Critics of the system say that many of the asylum seekers have been coached and told what to say, and that will help them, you know, get into immigration court and then maybe allowed to proceed into the United States and be here for a number of years while their case goes through the system. Have you seen people being coached? Are you able to tell if they're being coached as a judge?
So what we have highlighted on that is that to the extent that there's any concern that someone has been coached, the best way to assess it is to give it more time, because the more you question someone, the more that they are pushed to go outside of the four corners of whatever story they've been told, the easier it's going to be able to determine that, oh, this is a coached story. But if I don't have enough time, if I'm being forced and I'm concerned about how quickly I need to finish this, then that's going to make it actually much more difficult for us to have a system that has integrity to it. And that's one of the reasons that we've said that if you want more efficient management of the dockets, and if you want a court system that has integrity, you really have to ultimately move the court outside of the Justice Department and give it the independence and let judges be judges.
Right, because the number one prosecutor in the country, the Attorney General, is also the person who's the jefe, the boss in charge of immigration court. And he's able to change the rules as he sees fit in order to help him achieve sometimes political goals and not necessarily achieve the justice or a sanctuary that we were trying to provide when we adopted these laws.
And that's that's one of the problems that we see, is that the structure allows the prosecutor to step in at any point and veto or rewrite the rules. And it doesn't matter which administration, we see this with all administrations.
All right, taking another break. We're talking about asylum seekers and their rights and the responsibility of the United States. 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The nation's roughly 400 immigration judges were hit hard during the recent partial government shutdown. They missed paychecks, and also their courts were kind of frozen. They didn't have interpreters, they didn't have court attorneys, they didn't have the whole business, everyone you need to do in order to have an immigration court. It's not just the judges, it was everyone who couldn't work. And so while that happened, things piled up, paperwork piled up, court cases got pushed back, and it was confusion. Now that we have the government back open, who knows how long that'll last. But, you know, we know that they're still being told that they have got to get these cases processed. There's a new quota system that was announced in October by the Department of Justice. It says that all judges would be required to complete 700 immigration cases in the following year. And if they fall behind, they're going to lose their jobs. So how does this process work with our immigration judges and immigration courts? We're joined by the Honorable A. Ashley Tabador. She's the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. So is that a good summary of what's happening here?
Yes. During the furlough, we had close to three quarters of our judges basically being told that you can't come in. So all the cases that were what we call non-detained, individuals who are not in actual physical custody, those hearings were all canceled. I believe the latest numbers are close to 90,000 hearings were canceled. And upon the conclusion of the shutdown, we had requested to have some time to be able to get back up to speed because there are literally dozens of boxes of paperwork and mail that had been stacking up for those 34 days. People haven't had the time to review any of the cases for their upcoming week. We were told you need to come back and conduct yourself, quote unquote, business as usual, which is frankly a reflection of the constant issue that we are dealing with in terms of the use of the backlog as a tool to further particular law enforcement agency policies.
210-614-8980. We're having a conversation about asylum seekers and their rights and the responsibility of the United States government to provide asylum to people who come to our shore seeking it. And what does that look like? 210-614-8980. So there's also an issue with immigration judges with their morale. Many of them are resigning.
Yes.
Some of them are dying. It's a stressful job. I've heard that there's it takes a toll.
Absolutely. I mean, being a judge itself has a is challenging. As you know, we've done studies in the past that have demonstrated that judges do suffer essentially sort of a secondary post-traumatic stress disorder to the extent that you're constantly being exposed to people's trauma. Every day on a daily basis, we're hearing what other people have had to go through, and that takes its toll on judges. But that comes with the job. I mean, that's something that you know you're going to have to do, and you have to deal with that. Unfortunately, when you then add the artificial challenges, such as the quotas and the deadlines and the speeding up and what is essentially this aimless docket shuffling, something that most people don't appreciate is that one of the reasons for the backlog, and probably the primary reason for the backlog that we're seeing, which is now over 810,000 cases for about 400 judges, is that constantly, for law enforcement purposes, our dockets are being reorganized. So we are told practically, you know, every other month or once every few months that you need to now put these groups of people ahead of the line. Now, then
like juveniles go first. And
yes.
That's the adult asylum seekers are back of the line. And, you know, and so that adds more chaos.
So, for example, with the previous administration in 2014, they decided to put recent arrivals who are unaccompanied children and adults with children in front of the line. So hundreds of thousands of cases had to come to a standstill so that we can accommodate this new wave of cases. And that takes time for those cases to then get ready for trial. And that introduces backlogs and delays. Then with this administration, the first thing they did is they dropped about a third of the judges' dockets and sent them to the quote-unquote border court, essentially as a show of force. But then that means all of those judges, about 100 of them, had to drop their cases, hundreds of cases a week, to just be transferred for purposes of law enforcement needs. Then,
yeah, I heard that some of the immigration judges that were sent to these border courts as an emergency measure, didn't really have anything to do once they got there.
We had colleagues who had to drop a week's worth or 2 weeks worth of cases, maybe 100 cases, to go find themselves sitting in a courtroom that doesn't have the basic the furniture or much less the files. And sometimes they weren't even being expected there. So we had law clerks who had shown up to courts, and they were told, "What are you doing here?" So it really was, again, highlighting what happens when you use a court as an extension of law enforcement policies. So we're seeing, again, another reprioritization of our dockets. They're now called FAMU, family unity cases. In the most ironic sense, what this administration has done is taken the previous administration's adult with children docket, rebranded it as family unity docket, and said, all right, now you're going to have to put those cases in front of the line. So we find our judges having to then delay the previous adult with children cases to accommodate the new adult with children cases. It is maddening, frankly, sometimes to just sit there and imagine, why are we not allowed to do what we are best equipped to do, be judges?
So we know a lot about detention. We have children in detention, adults in detention. Are asylum seekers, are they ending up in detention?
Yeah, we certainly have individuals who are in detention facilities. About a third of our judges are assigned to what we call detained dockets. Those are courts where individuals are being held in detention facilities and their cases are being heard. Now, some of those individuals may be individuals who have been picked up in the United States, have had criminal convictions, and that triggers detention. But otherwise, individuals who are picked up at the border at the discretion of the Department of Homeland Security can be detained and have their cases heard through a detained docket.
Now, I've gone to immigration court here in San Antonio, the Children's Immigration Court, and you have small children who are being asked to function in this highly bureaucratic system, and they have, I don't know, what's the expectation there? I mean, they're in the courtroom, these kids, they're sitting in these big chairs, their feet don't even touch the ground, they're looking up, the judge is trying to be nice as they can, the interpreter is trying to be as nice as they can, they're trying to help this kid, but what can you really expect that child to do?
So I have been presiding over the unaccompanied children docket in Los Angeles for about 10 years, and the challenges of addressing children's cases is real. They do fall, again, within two categories. The non-detained docket are those children who've been released into the care of an adult, let's say a parent or guardian. The problem is that they remain in court as an individual, single individual before the court. So the court has very limited authority over their parent or their guardian to ensure that the child is being adequately cared for. So that leaves a lot of open space, and then the judges have to make extra effort to make sure that those children are being adequately cared for by their parent or their guardian, and then, you know, if there's an attorney. In the detained docket, which is that they're still in the physical custody of the United States government, they're usually transferred from the Customs and Border Patrol to the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And in that custody, that's the process in which ORR is trying to find the appropriate parent or guardian in order to release that child to. But at the same time, the case is going forward. So a lot of times those children come to court. We've been fortunate that there's been a lot of friend of the court programs where attorneys come to court and sit with the child and to make them feel better while we allow the process to continue for that reunification.
So Pilar Martinez, you're a law student with St. Mary's School, Law School. Can you talk, and you've been working with a clinic helping people deal with their immigration cases. What are you seeing?
I've been lucky enough to work with the clinic for 2 years. I've been working on a variety of cases, several asylum. I've taken two cases to court, one in Parasol and one here in San Antonio. Both of them were seeking asylum. It's a great opportunity. Professor Schomer has taught us and she trains us, and we're well prepared when we're ready to go in before the immigration judge.
How has it impacted you to actually be with individuals and being their advocate as they deal with this life-changing event?
It's amazing. It's a great opportunity. It's very humbling also to hear what these people are going through, to hear their story, why they're fleeing their countries. And it's great to be able to sit next to them in court and help them fight their cases.
And they tell you that they are here seeking only here in the United States, because if they remained in their homeland, that they would be certainly killed.
Yes, definitely. If they were to lose their cases and get deported, they would be killed.
And what happened to those cases?
They are both granted. They're both living in, both cases are contributing to the Texas society. They're living lives, and hopefully they'll get their green cards and citizenship.
So what is their residency status once they become granted, you know, asylum?
So they'll be asylee status for a year, and then after a year, they'll be able to apply for a green card.
And so, and if they do anything like break the law or whatever, then that status is immediately revoked? Is that how that works, Judge?
So when you do apply for adjustment of status after a year, you have to demonstrate that you are not what's called inadmissible. And that means you have to show that you haven't broken the law and you haven't become public charge. You haven't, you know, there's a list of items that you have to show you have not fallen into. And so, yes, if you have issues with the crime, that may disqualify you from being able to change your status to a lawful permanent resident. And to the extent that you come to the attention of the government, they can then take law enforcement action against you and seek to have your asylum status revoked and have you deported from the United States.
Do you need to have a sponsor?
No.
No, you don't. Okay. And all right, so we're going to take a break. We're talking about asylum seekers and their rights. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. If you've got a question or a comment about how the system is working today, our immigration courts, it's complex. They're trying to be fair and transparent, but they're swimming against the current here. 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about asylum seekers. What are their rights? We know that on the southern border, we have caravans. We keep being told about the caravans coming up from Central America. These are people that are fleeing for their lives from places like Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, where criminal gangs have taken over vast swaths of their vast areas of those countries, and they're fleeing. Often they're fleeing because of their homelands are being destroyed. Many of these people are indigenous people, and their lands or the native forests are being taken down in order to make room for more palm oil orchards. There's a lot of international forces behind what's happening with the driving of these people from their homes, and they arrive on our southern border and they're being told, well, you're going to have to wait. And wait for what? We don't know. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980 as we talk about asylum seekers' rights. And so Ashley Schomer with the Immigration Law at the St. Mary's School of Law, you're having this symposium this weekend, and you're trying to help people, Erica, get up to speed on the changes. Is the law changing a lot?
The law itself has not really changed with respect to seeking asylum. What has changed is people's ability to get here and make their claims, and then certainly the interpretation of the law. We have seen changes with particular cases that Attorney General Sessions certified to himself. There was a case that was a decision issued, matter of AB, over the summer that tried to basically say that it would be very difficult for a person who has suffered domestic violence or violence perpetrated by a gang to qualify for asylum. Litigation was filed to challenge parts of that decision, and in December there was a decision out of the D.C. Circuit that actually found that some of the policies the agency had implemented as a result of the matter of AB decision were illegal. And going back to what the judge already explained, every case has to be determined on a case-by-case basis according to the facts and the evidence in that particular case. And so it is not permissible for the Attorney General to just say someone who suffered domestic violence can't qualify for asylum. The criteria that a judge has to look at to be able to determine whether or not a particular person falls into what we call a particular social group or one of the other protected grounds depends on the evidence in that case, and it needs to be evaluated with respect to that particular individual.
Let's go to the phones with Melanie, 210-614-8980. And Melanie, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about the toddlers that are in, you know, being held. Is there some kind of way, if we wanted to become a temporary foster parents, is there some way we can do that, and who would we contact?
All right, Melanie, thank you for your call. Judge Tebador, how does that work?
To the extent that I'm aware of that is that the Office of Refugee Resettlement does work locally with various shelters or the city in terms of providing foster care or shelters to the children who are waiting to be reunited with their parents or an adult. So, you know, it just depends on the particular local shelter or the local foster sort of program that they're contracted with, and that's the way that you would then be able to be connected to the Office of Refugee Resettlement.
But there are a lot of safeguards, a lot of screenings that go in place to make sure that the people who do get involved here are have the best intentions and are qualified and capable of providing the necessary care.
Absolutely. From my understanding in dealing with the individuals who have come before the court is that the foster care programs are all certified programs, that they are all, you know, that they've gone through the screening process and individuals have had to have background checks. So, yes, that's my understanding.
So the asylum-seeking laws that we have in place today, they seem to be something that came about in post-World War II, as we saw terrible practices by our country and other countries rejecting refugees from Nazi Germany and sending people back to their deaths. Is that where the law evolved, Erica?
Yes, certainly. So it came out of following World War II, a series of meetings that ultimately ended with the writing of the Refugee Protocol, and then in 1980, our Congress basically took the U.S. obligations under the Refugee Protocol and codified it, made it part of the Immigration and Nationality Act, and wrote out the procedures that someone has to follow to be able to apply for asylum in the U.S.
Because there were people who were fleeing the Holocaust, came to the United States, they were rejected and sent back to Germany where they were put to death.
Yes.
And so these are laws and these are practices and these are principles that were created, hard-earned lessons, and we were told ourselves never again.
I think it is helpful to note that prior to these laws and sort of the UN Convention, there was this general default approach that, you know, what happens in somebody else's country, sort of that sovereign entity is this sacred entity, and there was no belief or feeling that we had any sort of responsibility or duty to interfere in that sovereign entity, that country. And the assumption was that that country needed to sort of deal with its own problems. But I think after World War II, there was a recognition that we are, while we are obviously all members of our own sovereign entity, that there is this international humanitarian relationship that we have and a trust and a responsibility to protect human beings when they are in those situations.
And so if we adopt some of the hardline asylum policies that are being put forth by the current administration, are we following that attitude, those principles? Or are we sort of sending people back to horrific circumstances where they're some people have been sent back recently, in the recent years, to find their deaths.
The other interesting point about the whole UN evolution and the refugee law is that if you take a look at it, as we said, it protects five particular grounds. So it is
Can
also...
Can you go over those five again?
Yes. It's race, religion, political opinion, national origin, and sort of a catch-all of particular social group. So it is still a reflection of a balance that was struck between in what circumstances do we feel as an international community that it's important for us to step in. So that is sort of a debate, and that's where the line was struck. Of course, the debate can continue, and we as judges do not take we don't participate on that because I think that's a policy decision and substantive law that needs to occur outside of the court in terms of decisions on how to change the law. We interpret it and administer it.
But this is also a global situation. We have a global refugee crisis as parts of the world are being destabilized. Certainly we know in Syria and Venezuela is also being destabilized. It's all in parts of Asia. You know, there are refugee camps and what's being done there. The United States, are we just looking at the southern border, or where are our concerns, Judge?
I can't really comment much about sort of the international issues outside of the United States, but I do think that in terms of the evolution of the law and the recognition of our role in it, part of that evolution of the law happens through the court system. So I think it's very important to make sure that people understand the difference between what's called a frivolous claim versus one that may not at this point be recognized under the law as a basis for protection. Maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, an individual who fell within the LGBTQ, for example, community would have been rejected for asylum. They would have been told, well, this doesn't fall within any of these five grounds. And there may have been even some arguments to say, well, then you shouldn't even have your opportunity to present your case. But that has changed over time. The evolution of the law based on the particular facts of those cases has grown to recognize now that basis under the particular social group category. So I think that our point from the judge's perspective and the court is that it is important to provide access and allow people to present their sincere and subjective fears and allow that process to be completed.
So we've over the past hour, as we've talked about this process, we've yoked that there is a strong connection between the political currents in the country shaping who our attorney general is, and our attorney general makes all these dictates and orders to immigration judges. So there's a lot of communication that has to happen with the overall population, has to understand who are asylum seekers, what are their rights, what are they fleeing from, and why do we care? And is that happening, Judge?
Wow, that's a pretty lofty question in terms of whether that's happening, you know, across the country.
Because there seems to be a lot of forces out there that are trying to make things confusing, and there's a narrative where they're saying the immigration courts don't work, therefore we need these other items like a wall.
I see what you mean. I think what has happened, and that's been frankly our challenge, is to sort of educate the public so that they would fully understand the structure of the immigration court and why the individuals who argue that the court doesn't work is not for the reasons that they claim it doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is because it is put in the Justice Department, is because it has become sort of an extension of law enforcement tools. And so we think it's important to educate people to recognize that the answer is to remove the court from the Justice Department, allow it to be independent, allow it to function as it should be. And we believe that then that is going to significantly reduce the backlog and is going to bring both efficiency and integrity to the system.
All right. Honorable Judge Ashley Tebador, she's the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. Also with us is Erica Schommer. She's an immigration law faculty member at St. Mary's School of Law. Pilar Martinez is a law student and symposium organizer for the Scholar St. Mary's Law Review and on Race and Social Justice. They have an event this evening at St. Mary's School of Law, and then there is one tomorrow all day at the Pearl. There's more information on our website at tpr.org. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.